Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com. Today is Thursday, December 22nd, 2011. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 69 for BadQuaker.com. I have a couple things today. The name of today's podcast is Do You Hate the State? Now, I stole that, blatantly stole that from Murray Rothbard. I'm gonna be reading part of Murray's little essay titled Do You Hate the State? This came from the Libertarian Forum, Volume 10, Number 7, dated July 1977. But I'm going to get to that in a minute. Before I get to that, I want to cover some groundwork and sort of lay a foundation. And in doing that, I want to be careful that I don't drive some of my listeners away. I have three short biblical references to go through. Now, and before I do that, let me clarify something. There are a couple of ways a person can think about the Bible or any other scripture or holy work or whatever. You can completely dismiss it as being entirely false and entirely useless and without any merit whatsoever, or you can embrace it as the ultimate. You can't adjust it. You have to change. You have to keep exactly word for word, and it cannot change any parts of the meaning or anything like that, and you have to believe it exactly as it is. Or there's some kind of saying in between where we can say, well, whether you believe that it's all true or not, you can still learn good lessons from old stuff that's been written a long time ago that holds, you know, certain things in it. You can probably find pretty much any book the size of the Bible, you could probably find some good lessons in it. So even if you're an atheist or if you're very, very, very much opposed to all things biblical, stick with me, because I'm not asking you to believe the Bible. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take three stories that appear in the Bible. I'm going to give a brief overview of them, and maybe we can look at a lesson that each of them will bring to us. Now, the first one comes from the book of Judges, and this is chapter 9, and it is the story of Abimelech. Now, Abimelech was a guy who decided he wanted to be king. There was no king at the time in Israel. Israel, for about 500 years, went with no central government whatsoever. There were tribal leaders. There were judges who were, it was a strictly on a voluntary basis. If you had a dispute with someone, you could take it to one of the voluntary judges, and they would settle your dispute. Or you could, deal with the situation however you felt best. But there was no central government in Israel for roughly 500 years. Now, during that time, they were surrounded with major empires in three different directions. And in addition to major empires, there were some very powerful city-states in the, right in the region that were not empires, but were very powerful city-states. And they had some serious aggressors, like the Philistines, were very close by and always somewhat of a threat. And yet for 500 years, they existed entirely stateless and did so in a complete state of liberty during that entire time. So that's the setting for the story in Judges chapter 9. And we get Abimelech that decides that he needs to be king. So he takes the proper steps that a king generally takes, which is, to kill a bunch of people and grab power. And he attempts to become king. And when one of the wise men of the area hears what Abimelech is doing, he goes up sort of on the side of this mountain and he gives a speech to whoever it was that would listen to him. And the inference in the scripture there would indicate that evidently this guy was pretty important, because quite a few people must have shown up to listen to him. Otherwise, he's just off rambling in the mountains again. Anyway, so this is basically an overview of the speech that this man gave in reference to Abimelech attempting to become king. He says this, the cedars desired a king to rule over all the trees. the olive tree refused. Now, the olive tree represents to us because the olive produces olive oil, and the priests used the olive oil in the blessings when they would anoint with olive oil when they were doing ritual blessings. So the olive tree in this story represents the anointing of God. So he says that the cedars came to the olive tree and asked the olive tree, "Will you be king over us?" And the olive tree refused. So now they have no anointing. It's this is not coming from God. So the cedars went to the fig tree and they begged of the fig tree if he would become king over all the other trees. And the fig tree refused. Now the fig tree represents sustenance and a prosperous economy. So if you are following along on this, the cedars are wanting a king. The olive tree represents the anointing of God, and he refused. The fig tree represents prosperity and sustenance, a prosperous economy. The fig tree refused because you can't have a prosperous economy and a king. And the state is what we're talking about. And so the cedars went to the grapevine, and the grapevine refused. Now the grapevine represents good cheer and fellowship. We get wine from the grapevine, and the wine brings us good cheer and fellowship. So what are you not going to have when you accept the state? Well, you're not going to have the anointing of God. You're not going to have the necessary sustenance and prosperity in the economy. And you're not going to have good cheer and fellowship, because the existence of the state destroys all those three things by its very existence. Okay, so then eventually the cedars were desperate and they went to the thorn bush. And the thorn bush accepted and became king of the trees. Now the thorn bush represents, the thorn is an invasive pest that brings only pain and will render a field unproductive. So in their desperation for a king, the cedars anointed the thorn bush king over them. And then in this parable, a wildfire raged through the land. Now the thing about a wildfire is, if you've ever seen one of these, I've witnessed them in California and in Nevada, and anybody that's seen how they move across like West Texas and Oklahoma and places like that. The fire burns really hot and moves really fast, but it will pass right by the tall trees, because tall trees, like the cedars in this story, the branches are up above the ground, and the trunk is the only thing that's really exposed to the heat. But because the low grass that you have in prairies and in arid areas, like you have in the Middle East, most of the brush and the grass is low, and so the fire just sweeps through very quickly. And generally speaking, now it doesn't always, the trees don't always survive, but if there's nothing but low grass and the low-lying stuff, then it'll sweep right through and it won't catch the main part of the trees. It won't catch the tops of the trees on fire. You have a real problem when there's enough fuel to let the flames get up high enough to get up into the body of the tree, into the canopy of the tree, and then you have a real problem, because it'll destroy your forest. So in the parable, the fire gets started and it starts raging across the land, and because the thorny brambles had such dominance among the trees, as they burned, the heat that they produced, and because they had overtaken so much, that they had so overgrown their natural position, that it caught the cedars on fire, and the very existence of the thorny bushes, by their very existence, they caught the cedars on fire and destroyed the forest. So that's the story, that's the parable given to us in the 9th chapter of Judges. And what eventually happens in the story, Abimelech announces himself as king, and there's turmoil because of it, and there's a lot of murder, and eventually he is killed. But in the process, like his whole family is killed, and it brings destruction to the whole area, and it's just a real upset, all because the cedars decided that they would accept the thorny bush as their king. Now, the bramble, the thorns, this also tells us something else, that for men, for humans, to humble themselves and accept a state, we never get the best, the cream of the crop. Never is the most intellectual, the most productive, the most honest. Those people are never the top of the state. What we get instead is, well, look at these people. I mean, just look at them. This, I don't have to go through and name all these slime that run governments, but that's who we get. We get the thorny bushes. We get the bramble of society running the state. We get them dominating the great cedars in life. And of course, the end is always destruction, and it's destruction because we have accepted the state, and we've exalted those that should have been under our feet, and we've exalted them up into the higher branches of society. Okay, now, our second story today comes from, also from the Bible, from the first book of Samuel in chapter 8. Now, in this situation, we're in the same time frame as we were in Judges there, roughly the same time frame, not exactly, but in that same 500-year period of liberty that Israel, where Israel existed with no central government whatsoever. So during this, at the end of this 500 years of liberty, and relative peace. Now, there were situations where they were attacked by foreigners, and there were situations where Israel had to defend itself, and a voluntary army stood up and took care of things. But if you compare the 500 years of liberty to what took place once Israel adopted the state, they were in pretty much perpetual war right up until their destruction. Once they adopted the state. So for this 500 years of relative liberty that they had relative peace compared to when they were under the thumb of the state. Okay, so in First Samuel chapter 8 is the story of the leadership of the tribes coming to Samuel and asking Samuel if he will. Oh, I'm sorry. Samuel is a circuit judge. He's one of these voluntary judges that goes around, and he has gotten quite old and is not able to get out and do stuff. And the current generation of judges, which is actually the ones that are accused, are actually Samuel's sons, are taking bribes, and things are just not working out good. So this is just an excuse that's used by the leadership of the tribes. So the leadership comes to Samuel and uses this excuse. Well, your sons are taking bribes. You have to appoint one of us as king. And that's what they want. These leaders are looking to Samuel, hoping one of them is going to be anointed by Samuel to be king of Israel. That's their desire. But seeing their motivation, seeing past their shallow words, Samuel is upset with them and is very offended, and he's very angered. And so rather than immediately give them an answer, he draws himself back and he prays about this. And what the Bible tells us is that God tells Samuel that by asking for a state, the people are not rejecting Samuel. They're rejecting God. This is the message God gives to Samuel when he's praying, that the people are not rejecting Samuel. It's not a personal thing. The people are rejecting God when they ask for a state. Now, you can read this for yourself if you don't believe me. It's in the first chapter. I'm sorry, in the first book of Samuel in chapter 8. Read it for yourself. It's as clear as day. So God, in speaking to Samuel, God compares the situation to when the people of Israel made a golden calf and began worshiping it not long after they left Egypt. And he says, it's like that. It's just like when they were bowing before golden idols. It's the same kind of a thing. They're rejecting me. When they went to accept the state, to desire the state, to want to be ruled by a state, is the same as worshiping an idol. It's grasping at a false god. That's what God tells Samuel in very clear terms. So God says to Samuel, go, give the people what they want, but you give them a clear warning and tell them exactly what they're really going to get. So this is what Samuel tells them, and you can read it for yourself, but and I'm kind of paraphrasing this because I don't want to take, you know, 3 pages explaining what it was that Samuel says. But basically Samuel says, okay, fine, you want a state, you'll have a state. But here's what you're going to get. This is what a state's going to bring you. The state will take your productive people out of the economy and will employ them to serve the state. The state will send spies in to watch you, the way the King James version of the Bible refers to having an ear to the ground, or other versions say an ear to the land. But either way, essentially the state is going to send spies among you. They're going to get into your business. They're going to want to see what you're doing, what you're up to, who you're trading with, why you're doing that. Then the state is going to take the best, what in quotation marks here, the best portion of your production and of your flocks and of your herds. Now, what is the best portion? Well, it can be argued that what it's talking about is the majority of your stuff is going to be taken by the state. Eventually, the state will start, it may start out taking, oh, you know, only 10% or only 20%. But at some point in time, the state will begin taking the majority of what you have. And today, in the United States of America, the state takes the majority of what we produce. It's well more than 50%. Now you may say, "Oh, I only paid 22% in my sales tax, in my income tax." Well, you're not adding everything up. If you go through and you see how many layers of taxation there is on how many things that you buy, for instance, if you fill up your gas tank of your vehicle with gasoline from a regular gas station, you're paying road taxes, you're paying gasoline taxes, you're paying sales taxes, you're paying taxes on the manufacturing when it was first pumped from the ground, when it was converted from crude oil into the different fuels that it's made into, each time it was transported in each different state that it was in. All of those things are taxed. All the labor that went to create, to get it out of the ground and to modify it and make it usable, and all the labor it took to bring it to you, all of that labor is taxed, and you pay for it when you buy that gallon of gas. Every penny that is given to the government on the many, many, many different levels, all through the whole manufacturing and transportation process, when it gets to you, you pay that. The consumer pays 100% of all tax. When a company like BP or some other oil company pays its income tax, assuming they're not like General Electric, assuming they actually do pay their income tax, when a corporation pays its income tax, it doesn't pay that income tax. You do when you buy gas. The money doesn't magically come out of nowhere for the corporation to pay its tax. It has to add that to the price of its product. And when every one of the investors who are the main investors who hold stock in that, when they pay tax on their dividends, that's you paying that tax. Otherwise, it all passes on to the consumer. The end consumer is the only person in the loop that pays tax. So in the United States, we're probably paying somewhere between 65 and 75% of what we earn in tax, just like Samuel said we would. Okay, let me get back out of the rant. So he says you're going to pay the best portion of your production and of your flocks and of your herds. And then he says the state will take the best of your young men and your young women. And you will have conscription. Now, today in the United States, people say, oh, well, we don't have a draft in the United States. Really? Every 18-year-old boy has to register for the draft. It's still here. It's just not enacted. But they can at any point in time. The fact that they can means that they own you. The draft is slavery. I'll go into that in a different podcast. Here's something else to think about: conscription. If the government destroys the economy to the point of where young people coming out of high school are desperate to earn wages, but the jobs are not there because the government has interfered in the economy so bad, and then they're dangled in front of them is this offer of, well, if you'll join the military, we'll get you into college, we'll pay for your education, you'll be able to learn a skill, you'll be able to come out of the military with a great skill, and you'll be able to get a job. A lot of that is lies. Now, that's not to say somebody doesn't get a job when they come out of the military, but if you compare the actual statistics of people coming out of the military and getting a job and people who didn't go to the military and still come out of high school or out of college or whatever and get a job, the statistics are not, there's no great advantage to being in the military to get a job any more than if you had done anything else on an apprentice level. And since the military is a subpar pay, you're not going to get paid in the military what you're going to get paid in anything comparable doing a comparable job. For instance, if you compare what your typical soldier is getting paid, say, out on the battlefield, and then you compare that to what a private security personnel will get paid for the exact same job on the battlefield, the private security individual is making dramatically more money than the soldier. If you compare, say, a radar technician, or you compare an auto mechanic, or you just go down the row, and what you're going to find is the military underpays its people dramatically. So if you worked as an auto mechanic in the private sector, you could afford, if the government weren't interfering in the private sector, you could afford to take much less money and work in the private sector and get the experience that the military gives you without being in the military, if the government weren't interfering in the market, but it is. Okay, so let's get back to this. The direction I was taking that is that in a sense, we have active conscription now in the United States because through the state's manipulation of corporations and the banking industry and everything else, the economy is damaged to the point of where some people in the United States are facing, you either go into the military or you have no way of making a living. That's a conscription in a particularly rude way, because you're just not giving a lot of these kids any other choice. And then the final thing that Samuel tells the people is that your sons will be taken off to fight in continuous wars. Now, keeping in mind they had been 500 years of liberty with only sporadic violence, and it was typically a very small and very short-lived. But the difference is, once you have a state, eventually the state always moves towards perpetual wars, always moves towards a continuous state of warfare. And the United States of America has achieved that today. So these are the things Samuel warns of. This is what you're going to get if you have the state. And they chose the state. And so the fate of Israel was sealed. And they got their king. Their king immediately went into continuous warfare. And then there was a struggle of one king fighting with another king. And a couple generations go by. And this kingdom is split. The northern half of the kingdom is wiped out and disappears into the sand of time. It's debatable what happened to those people. But an entire nation vanished from history. The southern part of the kingdom got the entire upper class of the nation was rounded up, made into slaves, and hauled away to Babylon for another 500 years in servitude. Well, the city of Jerusalem, that was the capital, was burned and sacked and pillaged. So that's what you get. That's the ultimate. The forest fire comes through and just takes out the cedars. Okay, so now the third thing from the Bible, I wanted to mention the story of David and Goliath. Now, this is going to be much shorter than the other two. David and Goliath. Now, some people will discount or discredit the story of David and Goliath because, A, there's no physical evidence of this David who grew up to be king and the empire that he built. The argument is, if David was real and he actually became king and did these things, why don't we see any of the physical things that he that was from that? Well, some archaeologists will argue that they have found evidence of that, but that's not our point for today. The other thing that people talk about when they try to discredit the David and Goliath story is this idea of how big Goliath was because of the use of the word giant. Now, I remember the old story that's titled, "In the Land of the Blind, a One-Eyed Man Can Be King." So all things are in comparison. We don't actually know the average height of the original tellers of the story. They may have been, you know, 5 foot, 5 foot two, 5 foot four as an average height of the original tellers of the story. And so what is a giant when you're 5 foot two? What is a giant exactly? Now, we have some conflicting versions of this story. Some of the versions say that that Goliath, this so-called giant, was 4 cubits and a span. And some stories go as high as 6 cubits and a span. Now, so the question is, what's a cubit and what's a span? Well, a lot of these old measurements were based on, like, the size from the tip of your elbow to the tip of your fingers, or some were the tip from your elbow to your wrist. The problem is, the bigger people are, the bigger the cubit is. And we had to pause there. BadQuaker.com regular listeners know that we have regular interruptions of dogs and cats and all kinds of creatures. When I was preparing for this podcast, there was actually a squirrel that came up and was messing with the screen door and caused the doorbell to ring. He is a regular visitor, and I have a box of nuts that I throw out for the squirrels. And so he regularly comes around and I toss him nuts. And evidently, I didn't get out there quick enough to throw nuts for him. So he came up and was messing with the screen door, which the latch on the screen door caused the doorbell to ring. So now I actually have a squirrel ringing the doorbell for nuts. So let's get back to the story. So I was talking about the height of Goliath. So it's anywhere from 4 cubits and a span to 6 cubits and a span, according to which scripture, which version of the Bible you read. And then we have to assume how big a cubit is, because the cubit, as I was saying, is based on the measurement of an arm. So a bigger person will have a bigger arm, and a smaller person will have a smaller arm. So that means we don't know how big Goliath was. But we can assume that if there's any truth to the story at all, he was probably not 9 or 10 feet tall. Some of the more realistic versions show him as probably being at or around 7 feet tall. Or even if he was close to 8 feet tall, that would still be a pretty big man. He would be doing well in the NBA today if that were the case. So to try to be realistic about this, we can just assume that he was a big man. So in the story of David and Goliath, we have a boy that's referred to as being ruddy, as being a small little guy, a lesser of his brothers. As a matter of fact, it actually says that he was the least of his brothers. He was not a trained for war. He was the one that was left back to take care of the flock while the real men went out to fight. And yet he went down and was watching the battle, and, you know, because according to his brothers, he was just being nosy, and he's always being nosy. He's always a busybody. So he goes down, sticking his nose where he wasn't supposed to be, and he ends up taking on this challenge from the champion of the Philistines. And in doing so, what he did... Now, we always get these goofy pictures given to us by half-wit Sunday school teachers of a little boy with a slingshot. No. What he had was a sling. A sling is a deadly weapon from from the ancient world. A sling would be generally two straps of leather, maybe in the range of 6 to 8 feet long, and it's got a little pouch with it, and you place a stone in it, and you place a stone anywhere from the size of, about the size of an egg up to about the size of a softball. So you can imagine now a weapon that you whiz around your head in a circular motion, and as you do so, you gain speed and momentum with that stone inside that pouch. And then at the right moment, you let go of one of the two straps, and that releases the stone. And so you can have a stone somewhere between the size of an egg and a softball that can be thrown at speeds over 100 miles an hour. Now just imagine yourself playing baseball with some of the really best baseball pitchers who have ever been in the NBA, in Major League Baseball. And imagine they're not throwing a baseball. Imagine they're throwing a rock. And if they were throwing a rock directly at you at 100 miles an hour, that would be pretty amazing. But a sling of that, the old type battle sling, like what I'm describing, could actually throw a rock bigger than a baseball, faster than the fastest pitcher ever recorded has thrown a baseball. So that's not a little cute little toy that a kid would be playing with or walking around with it in his back pocket. This is a serious weapon. And in the story, David used this weapon in defense of his flock, of his sheep. So you would use this at the time there were actually lions still in the area of in the area of Palestine. So he would have used this weapon in defense of his flock against things like lions and bears and people who would want to steal his flock. So this was a serious weapon. And what he did was he picked up his choice stones that he wanted, and he took one of them. I'm sure you know the story. And he taunted this Goliath, this champion. And when the champion charged him to engage in battle, he let fly the stone, caught the champion in the forehead with the stone, dropped him to the ground, ran over, jumped on top of him, grabbed the champion's sword, and hacked off his head and held it up at the army. Now, that's the story. That's essentially what happened. And the reason I'm bringing that up today is because I'm going to take a shot at Walter Block again. And if you're hearing this, and if you're a regular listener of badquaker.com, you're saying, you're going to take on Walter Block again? Yeah, I'm going to take him on again. On the same thing, he has put himself up as the judge of who can and can't be a libertarian, and he's put the test as whether or not you support Ron Paul. So what I want to do is I want to go back to this work of Murray Rothbard's. And this is a short thing that he wrote called "Do You Hate the State?" And it first appeared in the Libertarian Forum, and this is from Volume 10, Number 7, from July of 1977. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I will post the whole thing on badquaker.com so you can read it for yourself. What I'm going to read is a good portion of it, but I'm going to read excerpts of it. And let me just take right off and start this. "Do You Hate the State?" by Murray Rothbard. I have been ruminating recently on what are the critical questions that divide libertarians. Some that have received a lot of attention in the last few years are anarcho-capitalism versus limited government, abolitionism versus gradualism, natural rights versus utilitarianism, and war versus peace. But I have concluded that, as important as these questions are, they don't really cut to the nub of the issue, of the critical dividing line between us. Let us take, for example, two of the leading anarcho-capitalist works of the last few years, my own For a New Liberty and David Freeman's Machinery of Freedom. Superficially, the major differences between them are my own stand for natural rights and for a rational libertarian law code, in contrast to Friedman's amoralist utilitarianism and call for log rolling and trade-offs between non-libertarian private police agencies. But the difference really cuts far deeper. There runs through For a New Liberty, and most of the rest of my work as well, a deep and pervasive hatred of the state and all of its works, based on the conviction that the state is the enemy of mankind. In contrast, it's evident that David does not hate the state at all, that he has merely arrived at the conviction that anarchism and competing private police forces are a better social and economic system than any other alternative, or, more fully, that anarchism would be better than laissez-faire, which in turn is better than the current system. Amidst the entire spectrum of political alternatives, David Friedman has decided that anarcho-capitalism is superior, but is superior to an existing political structure, which is pretty good, too. In short, there's no sign that David Friedman, in any sense, hates the existing American state, or any state per se, hates it deeply in his belly as a predatory gang of robbers and enslavers and murderers. No, there is simply the cool conviction that anarchism would be the best of all possible worlds, but that our current setup is pretty fair up there with it in desirability. For there is no sense in Friedman that the state, any state, is a predatory gang of criminals. Now, for the purpose of this, I want to reread that little section, but I want to switch things around just so that I can put the rock in the pouch and give it a whiz. So, this is Murray Rothbard talking about David Friedman, and I'm just going to switch things around a little bit. There runs through For a New Liberty and most of the rest of my work as well a deep and pervasive hatred of the state and all of its works, based on the conviction that the state is the enemy of mankind. In contrast, it's evident that Walter does not hate the state at all. He has merely arrived at the conviction that anarchism and competing private police forces are a better social and economic system than any other alternative. Or, more fully, that anarchism would be better than laissez-faire, which in turn is better than the current system. And amidst the entire spectrum of political alternatives, Walter Block has decided that anarcho-capitalism is superior, but superior to an existing political structure that's pretty good, too. So, in short, there's no sign that Walter Block, in any sense, hates the existing American state, or the state per se, hates it deep in his belly as a predatory gang of robbers, enslavers, and murderers. No, there is simply the cool conviction that anarchism would be the best of all possible worlds, but that our current setup is pretty far up there in its desirability. For there is no sense in Block that the state, any state, is a predatory gang of criminals. Okay, so that's my little part there where I switched around David's name for Walter's name. Now, let me just read a little bit more of this to you so you get the idea of what Murray was saying. But really, to get the full impact of this article, get to Bad Quaker, badquaker.com, and read Murray's whole version of this. And keep in mind, like I said, it was written in 1977, so you might have to switch things around a little bit with who he's talking about. But to continue, he says, "Perhaps the word that best defines our distinction is radical." This would apply, side note from Ben, this would apply the difference between Walter Block and myself. "Perhaps the word that best defines our distinction is radical. Radical in the sense of being in total root and branch opposition to the existing political system and to the state itself. Radical in the sense of having integrated intellectual opposition to the state with a gut hatred of its pervasive and organized system of crime and injustice. radical in the sense of a deep commitment to the spirit of liberty and anti-statism that integrates reason and emotion, heart and soul. Furthermore, in contrast to what seems to be true nowadays, you don't have to be an anarchist to be radical in our sense, just as you can be an anarchist while missing the radical spark. And now he goes on to say, where are the Paines, the Cobdens, the Knox of today? Why are almost all of our laissez-faire limited governmentalist plunkies conservatives and patriots? If the opposite of radical is conservative, where are our radical laissez-faireists? If our limited statists were truly radical, there would be virtually no split between us. What divides the movement now, the true division, is not anarchism versus minarchism, but radicalism versus conservatism. And then Murray says this. He says, Lord, give us radicals, be they anarchists or no. And then he goes on to say a little bit later, taking the concept of radical versus conservative in our new sense, let us analyze the now famous abolitionism versus gradualism debate. The latter jab comes in the August issue of Reason, a magazine every fiber of whose being exudes conservatism, in which editor Bob Poole asks Milton Friedman where he stands on this debate. Friedman takes the opportunity of denouncing the intellectual cowards of failing to set forth feasible methods of getting from here to there. And then he goes on to say, the difference is that the abolitionist always holds high the banner of his ultimate goal, never hides his basic principles, and wishes to get his goal as fast as humanly possible. Hence, while the abolitionist will accept a gradual step in the right direction if that's all he can achieve, he always accepts it grudgingly, as merely a first step towards a goal which he always keeps blazingly clear. The abolitionist is a button pusher who would blister his thumb pushing a button that would abolish the state immediately if such a button existed. And then Murray goes on to say, it should be noted here that Milton's most famous gradual programs, such as the voucher plan, the negative income tax, the withholding tax, fiat paper money, are gradual, or not even so gradual, steps in the wrong direction, away from liberty, and hence the militants of much libertarian opposition to these schemes. Now here, let me just note, for all you greenbackers who might still be hanging on and listening to my podcast, that's who Murray's talking about. The fiat money, the fiat paper money advocates like Milton Friedman. This is not in the direction of liberty. It's in the wrong direction, away from liberty. And hence the militants of libertarian opposition to such schemes. Okay, back to Murray's words. The abolitionist's button-pushing position stems from his deep and abiding hatred of the state and its vast engine of crime and oppression. With such an integrated worldview, the radical libertarian could never dream of confronting either a magic button or a real-life problem with some arid cost-benefit calculation. He knows that the state must be diminished as fast and as completely as possible, period. And that is why the radical libertarian is not only an abolitionist, but also refuses to think in such terms as a four-year plan or some sort of stately or measured procedure for reducing the state. The radical, whether he be anarchist or laissez-faire, cannot think in such terms as, e.g., Well, the first year we'll cut the income tax by 2%, abolish the ICC, and cut the minimum wage. The second year we'll abolish the minimum wage and cut the income tax by another 2%, and reduce welfare payments by 3%, etc., etc. The radical cannot think in such terms, because the radical regards the state as our moral enemy, which must be hacked away at whenever and wherever we can. Many people have wondered, why would there be any important political disputes between anarcho-capitalists and minarchists now, in this world of statism, where there is so much common ground? Why can't the two groups work in complete harmony until we have reached a Cobdenite world, after which we can air out our disagreements? The answer to this excellent question is that we could and would march hand in hand in this way if the minarchists were radical, as they were from the birth of the classical libertarianism down to the 1940s. Give us back the anti-statist radicals, and harmony would indeed reign triumph within our movement. Again, go over to badquaker.com and read the article in its entirety. It's really well worth it. It'll take you about 12 minutes or so to read it, but it's really well worth just going through it and reading Murray's words and seeing how he dealt with the schism that was developing between the what he called the radical and the conservative of our movement. And so now we have the Ben Stone and the Walter Block. Walter evidently wants a president to be elected that will slowly diminish the power of government, and Walter calls this the last great hope of liberty. I want to find the button. I want to find the button, and I want to pound the button with everything within me. I want to find that button, and I want to mash that button and kill the state. And I know what that button is. The button is agorism. The button is free trade among us. The button is teaching people how to not depend on the state. The button is in showing people that the state is simply something you believe in that's not real. It only exists because you believe it exists. And the moment that you can see that there is no state, the state will vanish just like that. That's the beauty of radicalism. And that's the button. And that's how we push the button. We don't need a 4-year plan. We don't need to know every step. What do we do now? What do we do now? This is what you do. You grasp the concept in your mind that there is no state. There are only people who are acting immorally based on the fact that they can hide their acts. They can hide the responsibility for their acts by blaming it on the state. When you see a line of brutes lined up with clubs or with pepper spray or whatever, and they're brutalizing some person who's just trying to express their opinion, don't see the state. See a line of human beings that are using an excuse to go out and beat another human being. When you see those pictures coming from Egypt and the videos coming from Egypt, with the brutality that's going on, or the same thing that we're not seeing in several other countries right now, but it is happening. These things are not the acts of the state. They are acts of people who believe in the state. And when people stop believing in the state, they lose the excuses for their behavior, and they are forced by society to behave like the rest of us. And then there's no state. That's the button. That's the button. Push it. Push that button. For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go over to badquaker.com. Click the button and go to badquaker.com. Get over there. Thanks a lot, folks. I really appreciate you listening to me. The day the Constitution failed. In a previous article, the link can be found at badquaker.com, where this article appears, I established the fact that the preamble to the Constitution states the purpose of the Constitution and the purpose of the national state. Additionally, I lay out the argument that the state fails to achieve its stated purpose, and therefore the Constitution itself fails to provide what it promises. Also, in an earlier article, link found on the page where this article appears, I made the argument that the current government, functioning from its headquarters in Washington, D.C., openly violates the Constitution and is therefore an illegitimate authority and not a constitutional government. So then the point we're left with is to establish when the Constitution failed and if that failure could have been avoided and how the state can be restrained. Some people in the liberty movement would have us believe that the Constitution failed when the Patriot Act was signed, and all we have to do is repeal it, correct D.C.'s spending problem, and bring taxes down to an acceptable level, and America would return to its glory. Well, I would agree that the Patriot Act was a blatant trampling of not only the intent, but also the letter of the Constitution. It was simply the page of the book that people remember because it happened recently. But the Patriot Act was by no means out of the ordinary. It was simply business as usual for the many-headed monster that dwells in the city named after George Washington. Some people of my generation, and those a few years older than I, will point to the double hit the Constitution took under the guidance of a real pair of jokers, LBJ and Tricky Dick Nixon. True enough, undeclared war, monetary shenanigans, interference in a laundry list of third world countries, and the birth of the war on drugs took deliberate acts of treason against the Constitution and against the best interests of the American people. But again, it's just business as usual for this gang of thieves and their robber's roost on the Potomac. Some people more aware of the history of the progressive movement will point to one of three presidents that, it seems as we look back with hindsight, could not have made worse choices in setting the pace for the 20th century. Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and FDR each deserve a separate article showing how they could not have harmed America more had they been foreign-born enemies working openly to destroy America. We are told that the Constitution is the ultimate law of the land, and yet the actions of these three men proved the lawlessness of the office of the presidency and the uselessness of Congress and the Supreme Court in the task of checking and balancing government. Finally, some people will point to Abraham Lincoln as the killer of the Constitution, and it is true that the man responsible for the unneeded death of more Americans than anyone in history also trampled on the Constitution in his quest for power. But I want to take this story back a bit further. A Continental Congress adopted the Constitution of the United States of America on September 17, 1787. Under that Constitution, Congress had the power to levy indirect taxes. Direct taxes would be apportioned among the states in accordance with the census. So Congress could tax imports and exports through a duty tax, but couldn't directly tax citizens. George Washington was elected in 1789, and in March of 1791, the whiskey tax was passed and signed by Washington, who then personally assigned the revenue districts. Washington's districts differed as to how the amount of tax was determined and how it was collected. Therefore, distillers in the East, George Washington being the largest distiller at the time, paid less than half per gallon than the small distillers in the West. Also, on the frontier and in Appalachia, there was very little actual money, so whiskey, tobacco, and gunpowder served as universal mediums of exchange. For working people who were paid in whiskey, the tax was an income tax that the wealthy Easterners did not pay. So, in that dark year of 1791, with the Constitution just 4 years old, the very first president of the newly formed Constitutional Republic ignored the Constitution, broke the law, and proved that the state is a gang of thieves and nothing more. To add a little more fuel to this fire, consider some of the circumstances of the day. After the convenient crisis of the Battle of Wabash, Washington pressed for and got passage of the Militia Act of 1792, vastly expanding his power. However, rather than using his new military power in the old Northwest Territory, where the Battle of Wabash took place and the Indian situation was still active, he marched into Pennsylvania to intimidate citizen tax protesters. Again, think about Washington's actions carefully here. First, under Washington's direction, agreements with the Shawnee and the Miami were tossed aside, and the Ohio Valley was open to settlement. Washington stood to make huge sums of money due to his long-running land schemes in the area. Then, an undermanned force led by one incompetent fool and one drunk charged headlong into the Wabash against a seasoned, reinforced, heavily supplied Conference of the Western Confederacy representing some 10 Indian tribes in addition to elements of the Council of Three Fires, the Iroquois Confederacy, the Seven Nations, the Wabash Confederacy, and the Miami Confederacy, who were in the process of trying to decide how to protect their land. The casualty rate of the Battle of the Wabash was the highest percentage ever suffered by a United States Army unit. Approximately one quarter of the entire U.S. Army had been wiped out in a single day of battle. Congress responded by handing Washington an army and the power to act. But rather than lead his men into battle to face Little Turtle of the Miamis and Blue Jacket of the Shawnees, the great father of his nation and war hero of the Revolution chose to use his new military might to break up a tax protest in Pennsylvania. And to get there, Washington went the long way through the Low Country rather than chance the direct route through modern-day West Virginia. George knew that the sharpshooting Scott Irish of Appalachia with their Kentucky rifles would give him the same welcome Blue Jacket would have afforded him. So then, we must return to our original thought. When did the Constitution fail, and could that failure have been avoided, or can it be reversed? At this point, you would likely be expecting me to say the Constitution failed with the passage of the whiskey tax. In my opinion, the unconstitutional whiskey tax was the natural result of the outrageous debt the country was facing. That, along with the fact that it was the brainchild of one Alexander Hamilton, who happened to be entirely in the pockets of the banks that financed the debt and the big eastern distillers who stood to gain by the elimination of their small competitors. You see, the Constitution never had a chance and was a failure when the Continental Congress came together to dump the Articles of Confederation and discuss a federal government, which was also heavily supported by Hamilton, his bankers, and Washington himself. Men like Hamilton know the state cannot be restrained any more than water can be kept from the sea. But men like Hamilton, Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, FDR, LBJ, and Nixon all know that people can be fooled and the game can continue as long as the big lie is believed. The big lie that the state can be restrained. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening.